The Secret Servant by Daniel Silva. For Stacy and Henry Winkler, for their friendship, support, and tireless work on behalf of children. And as always, for my wife, Jamie, and my children, Lily and Nicholas. On present demographic trends, by the end of the 21st century at the latest, Europe will be Muslim. Bernard Lewis. The threat is serious, is growing, and will, I believe, be with us for a generation. It is a sustained campaign, not a series of isolated incidents. It aims to wear down our will to resist. Dame Eliza Manningham Buller, Director General of MI5. If you send a prisoner to Jordan, you get a better interrogation. If you send a prisoner, for instance, to Egypt, you will probably never see him again. Robert Bayer, as quoted by Stephen Gray in Ghost Plane. The Secret Servant. Part 1. Death of a Prophet. Chapter 1. Amsterdam. It was Professor Solomon Rosner who sounded the first alarm, though his name would never be linked to the affair except in the secure rooms of a drab office building in downtown Tel Aviv. Gabriel Alon, the legendary but wayward son of Israeli intelligence, would later observe that Rosner was the first asset in the annals of office history to have proven more useful to them dead than alive. Those who overheard the remark found it uncharacteristically callous, but in keeping with the bleak mood that by then had settled over them all. The backdrop for Rosner's demise was not Israel, where violent death occurs all too frequently, but the normally tranquil quarter of Amsterdam known as the Old Side. The date was the first Friday in December, and the weather was more suited to early spring than the last days of autumn. It was a day to engage in what the Dutch so fondly refer to as gezelligheid, the pursuit of small pleasures. A nameless stroll through the flower stalls of the Bloemenmarkt, a lager or two in a good bar in the Rembrandtplein, or for those so inclined, a bit of fine cannabis in the brown coffee houses of the Haarlemmerstraat. Leaving the fretting and fighting to the hated Americans, stately old Amsterdam murmured that golden late autumn afternoon. Today we give thanks for having been born blameless and Dutch. Solomon Rosner did not share the sentiments of his countrymen, but then he seldom did. Though he earned a living as a professor of sociology at the University of Amsterdam, it was Rosner's Center for European Security Studies that occupied the lion's share of his time. His legion of detractors saw evidence of deception in the name, for Rosner served not only as the center's director, but was its only scholar in residence. Despite those obvious shortcomings, the center had managed to produce a steady stream of authoritative reports and articles detailing the threat posed to the Netherlands by the rise of militant Islam within its borders. Rosner's last book, The Islamic Conquest of the West, had argued that Holland was now under a sustained and systematic assault by jihadist Islam. The goal of this assault, he maintained, was to colonize the Netherlands and turn it into a majority Muslim state where, in the not-too-distant future, Islamic law, or Sharia, would reign supreme. The terrorists and the colonizers were two sides of the same coin, he warned, and unless the government took immediate and drastic action, everything the free-thinking Dutch held dear would soon be swept away. The Dutch literary press had been predictably appalled. Hysteria, said one reviewer. Racist claptrap, said another. More than one took pains to note that the views expressed in the book were all the more odious, given the fact that Rosner's grandparents had been rounded up with 100,000 other Dutch Jews and sent off to the gas chambers at Auschwitz. All agreed that what the situation required was not hateful rhetoric like Rosner's, but tolerance and dialogue. Rosner stood steadfast in the face of the withering criticism, adopting what one commentator described as the posture of a man with his finger wedged firmly in the dike. Tolerance and dialogue by all means, Rosner responded, but not capitulation. We Dutch need to put down our Heinekens and hash pipes and wake up, he snapped during an interview on Dutch television. Otherwise, we are going to lose our country. The book and surrounding controversy had made Rosner the most vilified and, in some quarters, celebrated man in the country. It had also placed him squarely in the sights of Holland's homegrown Islamic extremists. Jihadist websites, which Rosner monitored more closely than even the Dutch police, burned with sacred rage over the book, and more than one forecast his imminent execution. An imam in the neighborhood known as the Oud West instructed his flock that Rosner the Jew must be dealt with harshly, and pleaded for a martyr to step forward and do the job. The feckless Dutch interior minister responded by proposing that Rosner go into hiding, an idea Rosner vigorously refused. He then supplied the minister with a list of 10 radicals he regarded as potential assassins. The minister accepted the list without question, for he knew that Rosner's sources inside Holland's extremist fringe were in most cases far better than those of the Dutch security services. At noon on that Friday in December, Rosner was hunched over his computer in the second-floor office of his canal house at Groenbergwal 2A. The house, like Rosner himself, was stubby and wide and tilted forward at a precarious angle, which some of the neighborhood saw as fitting, given the political views of its occupant. If it had one serious drawback, it was its location, for it stood not 50 yards from the bell tower of the Zuiderkerk Church. The bells tolled mercilessly each day, beginning at the stroke of noon and ending 45 minutes later. Rosner, sensitive to interruptions and unwanted noise, had been waging a personal jihad against them for years. Classical music, white noise machines, soundproof headphones, all had proven useless in the face of the onslaught. Sometimes he wondered why they were rung at all. The old church had long ago been turned into a government housing office, a fact that Rosner, a man of considerable faith, saw as a fitting symbol of the Dutch morass. Confronted by an enemy of infinite religious zeal, the secular Dutch had turned their churches into bureaus of the welfare state. A church without faithful, thought Rosner, in a city without God. At 12:10, he heard a faint knock, and looked up to find Sophie Vanderhaus leaning against the door jamb with a batch of files clutched to her breast. A former student of Rosner's, she had come to work for him after completing a graduate degree on the impact of the Holocaust on post-war Dutch society. She was part secretary and research assistant, part nursemaid and surrogate daughter. She kept his office in order and typed the final drafts of all his reports and articles. She was the minder of his impossible schedule and tended to his appalling personal finances. She even saw to his laundry and made certain he remembered to eat. Earlier that morning, she had informed him she was planning to spend a week in St. Martin over the new year. Rosner, upon hearing the news, had fallen into a profound depression.
"You have an interview with De Telegraaf in an hour," she said. "Maybe you should have something to eat and focus your thoughts."
"Are you suggesting my thoughts lack focus, Sophie?"
"I'm suggesting nothing of the sort. It's just that you've been working on that article since 5:30 this morning. You need something more than coffee in your stomach."
"It's not that dreadful reporter who called me a Nazi last year."
"Do you really think I'd let her near you again?"
She entered the office and started straightening his desk.
"After the interview with De Telegraaf, you go to the NOS studios for an appearance on Radio 1. It's a call-in program, so it's sure to be lively. Do try not to make any more enemies, Professor Rosner. It's getting harder and harder to keep track of them all."
"I'll try to behave myself, but I'm afraid my forbearance is now gone forever."
She peered into his coffee cup and pulled a sour face.
"Why do you insist on putting out your cigarettes in your coffee?"
"My ashtray was full."
"Try emptying it from time to time."
She poured the contents of the ashtray into his rubbish bin and removed the plastic liner.
"And don't forget you have the forum this evening at the university."
Rosner frowned. He was not looking forward to the forum. One of the other panelists was the leader of the European Muslim Association, a group that campaigned openly for the imposition of Sharia in Europe and the destruction of the State of Israel. It promised to be a deeply unpleasant evening.
"I'm afraid I'm coming down with a sudden case of leprosy," he said.
"They'll insist that you come anyway. You're the star of the show."
He stood and stretched his back.
"I think I'll go to Café de Dolan for a coffee and something to eat. Why don't you have the reporter from the Telegraaf meet me there?"
Do you really think that's wise, Professor?
It was common knowledge in Amsterdam that the famous café on the Stalstraat was his favorite haunt, and Rosner was hardly inconspicuous. Indeed, with his shock of white hair and rumpled tweed wardrobe, he was one of the most recognizable figures in Holland. The geniuses in the Dutch police had once suggested he utilize some crude disguise while in public, an idea Rosner had likened to putting a hat and a false mustache on a hippopotamus and calling it a Dutchman.
I haven't been to the Dorlin in months.
That doesn't mean it's any safer.
I can't live my life as a prisoner forever, Sophie.
He gestured toward the window.
Especially on a day like today. Wait until the last possible minute before you tell the reporter from the Telegraph where I am. That will give me a jump on the jihadists.
That isn't funny, Professor.
She could see there was no talking him out of it. She handed him his mobile phone.
At least take this so you can call me in an emergency.
Rosner slipped the phone into his pocket and headed downstairs. In the entry hall, he pulled on his coat and trademark silk scarf and stepped outside. To his left rose the spire of the Zuiderkerk. To his right, 50 yards along a narrow canal lined with small craft, stood a wooden double drawbridge. The Groenburgwal was a quiet street for the old side. No bars or cafes, only a single small hotel that never seemed to have more than a handful of guests. Directly opposite Rosner's house was the street's only eyesore, a modern tenement block with a lavender and lime pastel exterior. A trio of house painters dressed in smudged white coveralls was squatting outside the building in a patch of sunlight. Rosner glanced at the three faces, committing each to memory, before setting off in the direction of the drawbridge. When a sudden gust of wind stirred the bare tree limbs along the embankment, he paused for a moment to bind his scarf more tightly around his neck and watch a plump vermeer cloud drift slowly overhead. It was then that he noticed one of the painters walking parallel to him along the opposite side of the canal. Short, dark hair, a high, flat forehead, a heavy brow over small eyes. Rosner, connoisseur of immigrant faces, judged him to be a Moroccan from the Rif Mountains. They arrived at the drawbridge simultaneously. Rosner paused again, this time to light a cigarette he did not want, and watched with relief as the man turned to the left. When he disappeared round the next corner, Rosner headed in the opposite direction toward the Dolan. He took his time making his way down the Stalstraat, now dawdling in the window of his favorite pastry shop to gaze at that day's offerings, now sidestepping to avoid being run down by a pretty girl on a bicycle, now pausing to accept a few words of encouragement from a ruddy-faced admirer. He was about to step through the entrance of the café when he felt a tug at his coat sleeve. In the few remaining seconds he had left to live, he would be tormented by the absurd thought that he might have prevented his own murder had he resisted the impulse to turn around. But he did turn around, because that is what one does on a glorious December afternoon in Amsterdam when one is summoned in the street by a stranger. He saw the gun only in the abstract. In the narrow street, the shots reverberated like cannon fire. He collapsed onto the cobblestones and watched helplessly as his killer drew a long knife from the inside of his coveralls. The slaughter was ritual, just as the imams had decreed it should be. No one intervened. Hardly surprising, thought Rosner, for intervention would have been intolerant, and no one thought to comfort him as he lay dying. Only the bells spoke to him. A church without faithful, they seemed to be saying, in a city without God. Chapter 2. Ben-Gurion Airport, Israel.
What are you doing here, Uzi?
Gabriel asked.
You're the boss now. Bosses don't make midnight airport runs. They leave that sort of work to the flunkies in transport.
I had nothing better to do.
Nothing better to do than hang around the airport waiting for me to come off a plane from Rome? What's wrong? You didn't think I'd really come back this time?
Uzi Nabot didn't respond. He was now peering through the one-way glass window of the VIP reception room into the arrivals hall, where the other passengers from the Rome flight were queuing up at passport control. Gabriel looked around. The same faux limestone walls, the same tired-looking leather couches, the same smell of male tension and burnt coffee. He had been coming to this room, or versions of it, for more than 30 years. He had entered it in triumph,
and staggered into it in failure. He had been fated in this room and consoled by a prime minister, and once he had been wheeled into it with a bullet wound in his chest, but it never changed.
Bella needed an evening to herself, Nabot said, still facing the glass.
He looked at Gabriel.
Last week, she confessed that she liked it better when I was in the field. We saw each other once a month if we were lucky. Now, he frowned, I think Bella's starting to have buyer's remorse. Besides, I miss hanging around in airport lounges. By my calculation, I've spent 2/3 of my career waiting in airport terminals, train stations, restaurants, and hotel rooms. They promise you glamour and excitement, but it's mostly mind-numbing boredom with brief interludes of sheer terror.
I like the boring parts better.
Wouldn't it be nice to live in a boring country?
But then, it wouldn't be Israel.
Nabot relieved Gabriel of his leather garment bag and led him out into a long, harshly lit corridor. They were roughly equal in height and walked with the same purposeful gait, but the similarities ended there. Where Gabriel was angular and narrow, Nabot was squat and powerfully built, with a round, turret-like head mounted atop wrestler's shoulders and a thick waist that attested to an affinity for heavy food. For years, Nabot had roamed Western Europe as a katza, an undercover case officer. He was now chief of special operations. In the words of the celebrated Israeli spymaster Ari Shamron, special ops was the dark side of a dark service. They were the ones who did the jobs no one else wanted or dared to do. They were executioners and kidnappers, buggers and blackmailers, men of intellect and ingenuity with a criminal streak wider than the criminals themselves, multilinguists and chameleons who were at home in the finest hotels and salons in Europe or the worst back alleys of Beirut and Baghdad. Nabot was new to the job and had been granted the promotion only because Gabriel had turned it down. There was no animosity between them. Nabot was the first to admit he was a mere field hand. Gabriel Lalonde was a legend. The corridor led to a secure door, and the door to a restricted area just off the main traffic circle outside the terminal. A dented Renault sedan stood in the reserved parking place. Nabot opened the trunk and tossed Gabriel's bag inside.
I gave my driver the night off, he said. I wanted a word in private. You know how the drivers can be. They sit around down there in the motor pool all day with nothing to do but gossip. They're worse than a sewing circle.
Gabriel got into the passenger seat and closed the door. He looked into the back seat. It was stacked with Bella's books and files. Bella was an academic who specialized in Syria and drifted in and out of government service. She was far more intelligent than Nabot, an openly acknowledged fact that had been a source of considerable tension in their long and turbulent relationship. Nabot started her car with a hostile twist of the key and drove it too hard toward the airport exit ramp.
How did the painting turn out?
He asked.
It turned out just fine, Uzi.
It was a Botticelli, wasn't it?
Bellini, Gabriel corrected him. Lament over the dead Christ.
He might have added that the sublime panel had once formed the cima of Bellini's remarkable altarpiece in the church of San Francisco in Pesaro, but he didn't. The fact that Gabriel was one of the world's finest art restorers had always made him the target of professional envy among his colleagues. He rarely discussed his work with them, even with Nabot, who had become a close friend.
Botticelli, Bellini, it's all the same to me.
Nabot shook his head.
Imagine, a nice Jewish boy like you restoring a Bellini masterpiece for the Pope. I hope he paid you well.
He paid me the standard fee, and then a little more.
It's only fair, Nabot said. After all, you did save his life.
You had a hand in it too, Uzi.
But I wasn't the one who got his picture in the paper doing it.
They came to the end of the ramp. Overhead was a blue and white traffic sign. To the left was Tel Aviv. To the right, Jerusalem. Nabot turned to the right and headed toward the Judean hills.
How's the mood at King Saul Boulevard?
Gabriel asked.
King Saul Boulevard was the long-time address of Israel's Foreign Intelligence Service. The service had a long name that had very little to do with the true nature of its work. Men like Gabriel and Uzi Nabot referred to it as the office and nothing else.
Consider yourself fortunate you've been away.
That bad?
It's the night of the long knives. Our adventure in Lebanon was an unmitigated disaster. None of our institutions came out of it with their reputations intact, including the office. You know how these things work. When mistakes of this magnitude are made, heads must roll, the more the better. No one is safe, especially Amos. The Commission of Inquiry wants to know why the office didn't realize Hezbollah was so well armed and why our vast network of well-paid collaborators couldn't seem to find Hezbollah's leadership once the fighting started.
The last thing the office needs now is another power struggle and battle for succession. Not with Hezbollah gearing up for another war. Not with Iran on the verge of a nuclear weapon. And not with the territories about to explode.
The decision has already been made by Shamron and the rest of the wise men that Amos must die. The only question is, will it be an execution, or will Amos be allowed to do the deed himself after a decent interval?
How do you know where Shamron stands on all this?
Navot, by his edgy silence, made clear that his source was Shamron himself. It had been years now since Shamron had done his last tour as chief, yet the office was still very much his private fiefdom. It was filled with officers like Gabriel and Navot, men who had been recruited and groomed by Shamron, men who operated by a creed, even spoke a language written by him. Shamron was known in Israel as a Memune, the one in charge, and he would remain so until the day he finally decided the country was safe enough for him to die.
You're playing a dangerous game, Uzi. Shamron is getting on. That bomb attack on his motorcade took a lot out of him. He's not the man he used to be. There's no guarantee he'll prevail in a showdown with Amos, and I don't need to remind you that the door to King Saul Boulevard for men like you is one way. If you and Shamron lose, you'll be the one who ends up on the street hawking your services to the highest bidder, just like the rest of the office's washed-up field men.
Navot nodded his head in agreement. And I won't have a pope to throw me a little work on the side.
They started the ascent into the Bab al-Wad, the staircase-like gorge that leads from the coastal plain to Jerusalem. Gabriel felt his ears pop from the altitude change.
Does Shamron have a successor in mind?
He wants the office to be run by someone other than a soldier.
It was one of the many peculiarities about the office that made little sense to outsiders. Like the Americans, the Israelis nearly always chose men with no intelligence experience to be their chief spies. The Americans preferred politicians and party apparatchiks, while in Israel the job usually went to an army general like Amos. Shamron was the last man to ascend to the throne from the ranks of operations, and he had been manipulating every occupant since.
So, that's why you're conspiring with Shamron? You're angling for Amos's job? You and Shamron are using the debacle in Lebanon as grounds for a coup d'etat. You'll seize the palace, and Shamron will pull the strings from his villa in Tiberias.
I'm flattered you think Shamron would trust me with the keys to his beloved office, but that's not the case. The Memune has someone else in mind for the job.
Me? Gabriel shook his head slowly. I'm an assassin, Uzi, and they don't make assassins, the director.
You're more than just an assassin.
Gabriel looked silently out the window at the orderly yellow streetlights of a Jewish settlement spreading down the hillside toward the flatlands of the West Bank. In the distance, a crescent moon hung over Ramallah.
What makes Shamron think I'd want to be the chief?
He asked. I wriggled off the hook when he wanted to make me chief of special ops.
Are you trying to drop a not-so-subtle reminder that I got the job only because you didn't want it?
What I'm trying to say, Uzi, is that I'm not fit for headquarters, and I certainly don't want to spend my life in endless security cabinet meetings in the Prime Minister's office. I don't play well with others, and I won't be a party to your little conspiracy against Amos.
So, what do you intend to do? Sit around and wait for the Pope to give you more work?
You're starting to sound like Shamron.
Navot ignored the remark.
Sit around while the missiles rain down on Haifa? While the mullahs in Tehran build their nuclear bomb? Is that your plan, to leave the fighting to others?
Navot took a long look into the rearview mirror.
But why should you be any different? At the moment, it's a national affliction.
Fortress Israel is cracking under the strain of this war without end. The founding fathers are dying off, and the people aren't sure they trust the new generation of leaders with their future. Those with the resources are creating escape hatches for themselves. It's the Jewish instinct, isn't it? It's in our DNA because of the Holocaust. One hears things now that one didn't hear even 10 years ago. People wonder openly whether the entire enterprise was a mistake. They delude themselves into thinking that the Jewish national home is not in Palestine, but in America.
America? Nevot fixed his eyes back on the road.
My sister lives in Bethesda, Maryland. It's very nice there. You can eat your lunch in an outdoor cafe without fear that the next person who walks by your table is a shahid who's going to blow you to bits.
He glanced at Gabriel.
Maybe that's why you like Italy so much. You want to make a new life for yourself away from Israel. You want to leave the blood and tears to mere mortals.
Gabriel's dark look made clear he had shed more blood and tears for his country than most. I am an art restorer who specializes in Italian old masters. The paintings are in Italy, Uzi, not here.
Art restoration was your cover job, Gabriel. You are not an art restorer. You are a secret servant of the State of Israel, and you have no right to leave the fighting to others. And if you think you're going to find a quiet life for yourself in Europe, forget it. The Europeans condemned us for Lebanon, but what they don't understand is that Lebanon is merely a preview of coming attractions. The movie will soon be showing in theaters all across Europe. It's the next battleground.
The next battleground? No, thought Gabriel. It had been his battleground for more than 30 years. He looked up at the looming shadow of Mount Herzl, where his former wife resided in a psychiatric hospital, locked in a prison of memory and in a body destroyed by Gabriel's enemies. His son was on the other side of Jerusalem, in a hero's grave on the Mount of Olives. Between them lay the Valley of Hinnom, an ancient burning ground believed by both Jews and Muslims to be the fiery place where the wicked are punished after death. Gabriel had spent the better part of his life traversing the valley. It was clear that Uzi Nevot wanted him to return again.
What's on your mind, Uzi? Surely you didn't come all the way to the airport just to ask me to join your plot against Amos.
We have an errand we'd like you to run for us, Nevot said.
I'm not an errand boy.
No offense, Gabriel.
None taken. Where's the errand?
Amsterdam.
Why Amsterdam?
Because we've had a death in the family there.
Who?
Solomon Rosner.
Rosner? I never knew Rosner was ours.
He wasn't ours, said Nevot. He was Shemron's.
Chapter 3. Jerusalem. They drove to Narkis Street, a quiet, leafy lane in the heart of Jerusalem, and parked outside the limestone apartment house at number 16. It was 3 floors in height and largely concealed by a towering eucalyptus tree growing in the front garden. Gabriel led Nevot through the small foyer and mounted the stairs. Despite his long absence, he didn't bother to check the postbox. He never received mail, and the name on the box was false. As far as the bureaucracy of the State of Israel was concerned, Gabriel Allon did not exist. He lived only in the office, and even there he was a part-time resident. His flat was on the top floor. As always, he hesitated before opening the door. The room that greeted him was not the same one he had walked out of 6 months earlier. It had been a small but fully functioning art studio. Now it was meticulously decorated in the subtle beiges and soft whites that Chiara Zoli, his Venetian-born fiancée, so adored. She'd been busy while he was away. Somehow, she'd neglected to mention the redecoration during her last visit to Italy.
Where are my things? Housekeeping has them in storage until you can find some proper studio space.
Nevot smiled at Gabriel's discomfort.
You didn't expect your wife to live in an apartment without furniture, did you?
She's not my wife yet.
He laid his bag on the new couch. It looked expensive.
Where is she?
She didn't tell you where we were sending her.
She takes rules of compartmentalization and need to know very seriously.
So do I.
Where is she, Uzi?
Navot opened his mouth to reply, but a voice from the kitchen answered for him. It was familiar to Gabriel, as was the elderly figure who emerged a moment later, dressed in khaki trousers and a leather bomber jacket with a tear in the left breast. His head was shaped like a bullet and bald, except for a monkish fringe of cropped white hair. His face was more gaunt than Gabriel remembered, and his ugly wire-framed spectacles magnified pale blue eyes that were no longer clear. He was leaning heavily on a handsome olive wood cane. The hand that held it seemed to have been borrowed from a man twice his size.
Argentina, said Ari Shamron for a second time. Your wife-to-be is in Argentina.
What kind of job is it?
Surveillance of a known terrorist operative.
Gabriel didn't have to ask the affiliation of the operative. The answer lay in the location of the operation. Argentina, like the rest of South America, was a hotbed of Hezbollah activity.
We think it's only a matter of time before Hezbollah tries to take its revenge for the damage we inflicted on them in Lebanon. A terror attack that leaves no fingerprints is the most likely scenario. The only question in our mind is the target. Will it be us, or our supporters in America?
When will she be finished?
Shamron shrugged noncommittally. This is a war without end, Gabriel. It is forever. But then you know that better than any of us, don't you?
He touched Gabriel's face.
See if you can find us some coffee. We need to talk.
Gabriel found a tin of coffee in the pantry. The seal had been broken, and a single sniff of the grinds confirmed his suspicions that it was long past its prime. He poured some into the French press and set a kettle of water to boil, then returned to the sitting room. Navot was pondering a ceramic dish on the end table. Shamron had settled himself into an armchair and was in the process of lighting one of his vile-smelling Turkish cigarettes. Gabriel had been gone 6 months, but in his absence it seemed nothing had changed but the furniture.
No coffee? Shamron asked.
It takes more than a minute to make coffee, Ari. Shamron glared at his big stainless steel wristwatch. Time had always been his enemy, but now more so than ever. It was the bombing, Gabriel thought. It had finally forced Shamron to confront the possibility of his own mortality. Solomon Rosner was an office asset? Gabriel asked.
A very valuable one, actually.
How long? Shamron tilted his head back and blew a stream of smoke toward the ceiling before answering.
Back in the mid-90s, during my second tour as chief, we began to realize the Netherlands were going to be a problem for us down the road. The demographics of the country were changing rapidly. Amsterdam was well on its way to becoming a Muslim city. The young men were unemployed and angry, and they were being fed a steady diet of hate by their imams, most of whom were imported and funded by our friends in Saudi Arabia. There were a number of attacks against the local community, small stuff mostly, a broken window, a bloody nose, the odd Molotov cocktail. We wanted to make sure those small incidents didn't turn into something more serious. We also wanted to know whether any of our more determined enemies were using Amsterdam as a base of operation for major attacks against Israeli targets in Europe. We needed eyes and ears on the ground, but we didn't have the resources to mount any sort of operation on our own.
Gabriel opened the doors leading onto his small balcony. The smell of the eucalyptus tree in the front garden filled the apartment.
So you turned to Rosner?
Not right away.
We tried the traditional route first, a liaison relationship with the AIVD, the Dutch Security Service. We courted them for months, but the Dutch at that time weren't interested in dancing with us. After the last rejection, I authorized an attempt to get into the AIVD through the back door. Our local chief of station made a rather clumsy pass at the AIVD deputy in charge of monitoring the Muslim community, and it blew up in our faces. You remember the scandal, don't you, Gabriel?
He did. The affair had been splashed all over the pages of Dutch and Israeli newspapers. There had been heated exchanges between the foreign ministries of both countries and angry threats of expulsions.
When the storm died down, I decided to try again. This time, though, I chose a different target.
Rosner, Gabriel put in, and Shamroon nodded his head in agreement. He monitored what was being said in the mosques when no one else in Amsterdam was listening, and read the filth running through the sewers of the Internet when everyone else averted their eyes. On more than one occasion, he supplied information to the police that prevented violence. He also happened to be Jewish. As far as the office was concerned, Rosner was the answer to our prayers.
Who handled the recruitment?
I did, Shamroon said. After the AIVD scandal, I wasn't about to entrust the job to anyone else.
And besides, said Gabriel, there's nothing you love better than a good recruitment.
Shamroon responded with a seductive smile, the same smile he had used on a searing afternoon in September 1972, when he had come to see Gabriel at the Bezalel Academy of Art in Jerusalem. Gabriel had been a promising young painter. Shamroon was a brash operations man who had just been ordered by Prime Minister Golda Meir to hunt down and kill the members of Black September, perpetrators of the Munich massacre. The operation was codenamed Wrath of God, but in reality, it was the Wrath of Gabriel. Of the 12 members of Black September killed by the office, 6 were dispatched by Gabriel at close range with a .22 caliber Beretta.
I flew to Amsterdam and took Rosner to dinner in a quiet restaurant overlooking the Amstel. I told stories about the old days, the War of Independence, the Eichmann capture. You know the ones, Gabriel. The stories you and Uzi have heard 1,000 times before. At the end of the evening, I laid a contract on the table. He signed without reservation.
Shamroon was interrupted by the sudden scream of the tea kettle. Gabriel went into the kitchen and prepared the coffee. When he returned, he placed the French press on the coffee table, along with 3 mugs and a sugar bowl. Navot gave him a disapproving look.
You'd better put something under that, he said. If you leave a ring, Chiara will kill you.
I'll take my chances, Uzi. Gabriel looked at Shamroon.
Who serviced him?
You, I suppose.
Rosner was my creation, Shamroon said somewhat defensively. Naturally, I was reluctant to turn over the reins to anyone else. I gave him a bit of money to hire an assistant, and when Rosner had something to report, I was the one who went to see him.
In Amsterdam?
Never, said Shamroon. Usually we met across the border, in Antwerp.
And when they ran you out of the office for the second time?
I hung on to a few bits and pieces to keep me occupied in my dotage. Rosner was one of those bits. Another was you, of course. I didn't trust you with anyone else.
He spooned sugar into his coffee and gave it a melancholy stir.
When I went to work for the Prime Minister as his senior security advisor, I had to surrender control of Rosner.
He glanced at Navot.
I entrusted him to Uzi. After all, he was our Western European Gatsa.
And your protege, Gabriel added.
It wasn't exactly heavy lifting, Navot conceded. Ari had already done all that. I just had to handle Rosner's reports. 18 months ago he gave me a nugget of pure gold, according to one of Rosner's sources inside the Muslim community. An Al-Qaeda-affiliated cell operating in West Amsterdam had got their hands on a missile and was planning to shoot down an El Al jetliner on approach at Schiphol Airport. That evening we diverted the flight to Brussels and tipped off the Dutch. They arrested 4 men sitting in a parked car at the end of the runway. In the trunk was an anti-aircraft missile that had been smuggled into Amsterdam from Iraq.
How did Rosner know about the plot?
He had sources, said Shamroon. Very good sources. I tried on a number of occasions to convince him to turn them over to us, but he always refused. He said his sources talked to him because he wasn't a professional. Well, not quite a professional, but no one else in Holland knew that.
And you're sure about that? Asked Gabriel.
You're certain Rosner didn't die because of his links to us?
Unfortunately, there was no shortage of people in Amsterdam who wanted Solomon dead. Some of the city's most prominent jihadist imams had been openly calling for a volunteer to step forward. They finally found their man in Mohammed Hamza, a house painter from North Amsterdam who just happened to be working on a project across the street from Rosner's home. The Amsterdam police found a videotape inside Hamza's apartment after his arrest.
It was shot the morning of Rosner's murder. On it, Hamza calmly says that today would be the day he killed his Jew.
So, what type of errand do you want me to run in Amsterdam?
Navot and Shemron looked at each other, as if trying to get their story straight. Shemron let Navot answer. He was, after all, chief of special ops.
We'd like you to go to Amsterdam and clean out his files. We want the names of all those golden sources, of course, but we also want to make sure there's nothing there that might link him to us.
It would be deeply embarrassing if our ties to Solomon were ever exposed, Shemron added. And it would also make it more difficult for us to recruit Sayanim from the Jewish communities around the world. We're a small service. We can't function without them.
The Sayanim were a worldwide network of volunteer Jewish helpers. They were the bankers who supplied office agents with cash in emergencies, the doctors who treated them in secret when they were wounded, the hoteliers who gave them rooms under false names, and the rental car agents who supplied them with untraceable vehicles. The vast majority of the Sayanim had been recruited and nurtured by Shemron himself. He devotedly referred to them as the secret fruit of the diaspora.
It also has the potential to make a volatile situation in the Netherlands much worse, Gabriel said. Solomon Rosner was one of the most well-known critics of militant Islam in Europe. If it ever came out that he was our paid mouthpiece, the Jewish community in Holland might find itself at risk.
I disagree with your characterization, said Shemron, but your point is duly noted.
How am I supposed to get into Rosner's office?
It was Navot who answered.
About a year ago, when the threats against Rosner started coming fast and furious, we knew we had to make plans for just such a contingency. Rosner told his assistant, a young woman named Sophie Vanderhaus, that in the event of his death, she would be contacted by a gentleman named Rudolf Heller and given a set of instructions she was to follow to the letter.
Herr Rudolf Heller, venture capitalist for Zurich, was one of Shemron's many false identities.
I contacted Sophie last night, Shemron said. I told her that a colleague of mine would be arriving in Amsterdam tomorrow afternoon, and that he was to be given complete access to all of Professor Rosner's files.
Tomorrow afternoon?
There's an El Al flight that leaves Ben Gurion at 6:45 and arrives in Amsterdam at 2. Sophie will meet you in front of the Café de Dolen at 4.
It could take me days to go through all of Rosner's files.
Yes, Shemron said, as though he were glad the task had not been inflicted on him. That's why we've decided to send along some help. He's already in Europe on a personal matter. He'll be there when you arrive.
Gabriel raised his coffee cup to his lips and eyed Shemron over the rim.
And what about the promises we made to the European security services? The covenant we signed in blood in exchange for getting them to drop all the charges and lawsuits against me?
You mean the covenant that forbids you from operating on European soil without first obtaining permission from the security service of the country involved?
Yes, that one.
They all three shared a conspiratorial silence. Making promises they had no intention of keeping was what they did best. They abused the passports of other nations, recruited agents from Allied security and intelligence services, and routinely ran operations on foreign soil forbidden by long-standing accords. They did this, they told themselves, because they had no choice, because they were surrounded by enemies who would stop at nothing to ensure their destruction, and because the rest of the world, blinded by their hatred of Zionism and the Jews, would not allow them to fight back with the full force of their military might. They lied to everyone but each other, and were truly at ease only in each other's company.
You're not going behind the Iron Curtain, Shemron said. With proper cover and a bit of work on that now famous face of yours, you'll have no problems getting into the country. The new realities of European travel have made life much easier for office agents, and, unfortunately, for the terrorists as well. Osama bin Laden could be living quietly in a cottage by the North Sea, and the Dutch would never know it.
Navot reached into his attaché case. The envelope he removed was an old-fashioned model, with a string instead of an aluminum clasp.
The office was one of the most technologically advanced services in the world, but it still used envelopes from the days when Israel had no television.
It's an in-and-out job, Shamron said. You'll be home by the weekend. Who knows, perhaps your wife will be too.
She's not my wife yet. Gabriel took the envelope from Navot's grasp. An in-and-out job, he thought. It sounded nice, but somehow it never turned out that way.
Chapter 4 Amsterdam.
Name, please?
Asked the front desk clerk at the Hotel Europa. Kiva, Gabriel replied in German-accented English.
Heinrich Kiva.
Ah, yes. Here it is. Your room is ready.
There was genuine surprise in her voice.
You have a message, Herr Kiva.
Gabriel, playing the role of the travel-weary businessman, accepted the small slip of paper with a frown. It stated that his colleague from Heller Enterprises in Zurich had already checked into the hotel and was awaiting his call. Gabriel squeezed the message into a ball and shoved it into the pocket of his overcoat. It was cashmere. The girls in identity had spared no expense on his wardrobe.
Your room is on the 6th floor. It's one of our premier suites.
She handed him an electronic card key and recited a long list of luxurious hotel amenities Gabriel had no intention of using.
Do you require assistance with your bag?
Gabriel glanced at the bellman, an emaciated youth who looked like he had spent his lunch hour in one of Amsterdam's notorious brown cafes.
I think I can manage, thank you.
He boarded a waiting elevator and rode it up to the 6th floor. The door to Suite 612 was located at the end of a corridor in a small private alcove. Gabriel ran his fingertips around the jamb, searching for any sign of a foreign object, such as a fragment of loose wiring, and held his breath as he inserted the card key into the electronic lock. There was little premier about the room he entered, though the view of the canal houses along the Amstel River was one of the finest in the city. A bottle of mediocre champagne was sweating in an ice bucket on the coffee table. The handwritten note said, "Welcome back to the Europa, Herr Kiever." Strange, because to the best of Gabriel's recollection, Herr Kiever had never stayed there before. He removed a Nokia mobile phone from his coat pocket. It was indeed a telephone, but it contained several features unavailable on ordinary commercial models, such as a device capable of detecting the signals and electrical impulses of concealed transmitters. He held the phone in front of his face and spent the next 5 minutes padding slowly around the rooms of the suite, watching the power meter for subtle fluctuations. Satisfied the room had not been bugged, he conducted a second search, this one for evidence of a bomb or any other lethal device. Only then did he pick up the phone on the bedside table and dial room 611. I'm here, he said in German, and immediately set down the receiver. A moment later there was a gentle knock at the door. The man who entered was several years older than Gabriel, small and bookish, with wispy, unkempt gray hair and quick brown eyes. As usual, he seemed to be wearing all his clothing at once, a button-down shirt with ascot, a cardigan sweater, a rumpled tweed jacket.
Lovely accommodations, said Eli Levon. Better than that pensione where we stayed in Rome the night before the Zweta hit in 72. Do you remember it, Gabriel? My God, what a dump.
We were posing as university students, Gabriel reminded him. We can't pose as students anymore. I suppose that's one of the few fringe benefits of growing old.
Levon gave Gabriel an elusive smile and lowered himself wearily into an armchair. Even Gabriel, who had known Levon more than 30 years, sometimes found it hard to imagine that this fussy, hypochondriacal little man was without question the finest street surveillance artist the office had ever produced. They had worked together for the first time during the Wrath of God operation. Levon, an archaeologist by training, had been an Ion, a tracker. When the unit disbanded, he had settled in Vienna and opened a small investigative bureau called Wartime Claims and Inquiries. Operating on a shoestring budget, he had managed to track down millions of dollars in looted Jewish assets and had played a significant role in prying a multi-billion dollar settlement from the banks of Switzerland. He had recently returned to Israel and was teaching biblical archaeology at Hebrew University.
In his spare time, he lectured on the fine art of physical surveillance at the academy. No office recruit ever made it into the field without first spending a few days with the great Eli Levon.
"Your disguise is quite effective,"
Levon said with professional admiration.
"For an instant, even I didn't recognize you."
Gabriel looked at his reflection in the mirror over the dressing table. He wore a pair of black framed eyeglasses, contact lenses that turned his green eyes to brown, and a false goatee that accentuated his already narrow features.
"I would have added a bit more gray to your hair,"
Levon said. "I have enough already," Gabriel said. "How did you get roped into this affair?"
"Proximity, I suppose. I was at a conference in Prague delivering a lecture on our dig at Tel Megiddo. As I came off the stage, my mobile phone was ringing. You'll never guess who it was."
"Trust me, Eli. I can guess."
"I hear that voice, the voice of God with a murderous Polish accent, telling me to leave Prague for Amsterdam at once."
Levon shook his head slowly.
"Does Shamroen really have nothing better to do at his age than worry about a dead scion? He's lucky to be alive. He should be enjoying his last few years on this earth, but instead he clings to the office like a drowning man grasping at a life ring."
"Rosner was his scion," Gabriel said, "and I'm sure he feels partly responsible for his death."
"He could have let Uzi handle it. But he doesn't fully trust Uzi, does he, Gabriel? The old man wanted you in special ops, not Uzi, and he's never going to rest until you're running the place."
Levon pushed up the sleeve of his tweed jacket and looked at his watch.
"Sophie Vanderhaus awaits us. Have you given much thought to how you're going to play it with her?"
"She's an intelligent woman. I suspect she already has a good idea about Herr Heller's true affiliation, and why Rosner always met with him outside the country." Levon frowned.
"I must confess, I'm not really looking forward to this. I suppose there's a ritual to these things. When agents die, their secrets have to go with them to the grave. It's like Tahara, the washing of the dead. Next time it could be one of us."
"Promise me something, Eli."
"Anything."
"Promise me that if anything happens to me, you'll be the one who buries all my secrets."
"It would be my honor."
Levon patted the pocket of his jacket.
"Oh, I nearly forgot this. A Bodel gave this to me at the airport this morning after I arrived."
The Bodelim were office couriers. The item Levon had been given was a Beretta 9mm pistol. Gabriel took it from his grasp and slipped it into the waistband of his trousers at the small of his back.
"You're not going to bring that, are you?"
"I have enemies, Eli. Lots of enemies."
"Obviously, so did Solomon Rosner."
"And one of them might still be hanging around his house."
"Just try not to kill anyone while we're in Amsterdam, Gabriel. Dead bodies have a way of spoiling an otherwise uneventful trip."
It was beginning to get dark when Gabriel stepped out of the hotel. He turned to the right, and with Levon trailing several paces behind, walked the length of the narrow street until he came to an iron bridge. On the opposite side stood Café de Dolan. It was open for business again, and the spot where Solomon Rosner had been standing at the time of his murder was piled high with tulips. There were no mourners or protesters condemning the ritual slaughter of their fellow countrymen. Only a single banner hung from the facade of the café that read, "One Amsterdam, One People."
"I've been staring at it for 2 days now, and I still don't quite know what it means."
Gabriel turned around. The words had been spoken by a woman in her late 20s, with sandstone-colored hair and pale blue eyes that shone with a calm intelligence.
"I'm Sophie Vanderhaus."
She extended her hand and added primly,
"Professor Rosner's assistant."
She released his hand and gazed at the makeshift memorial.
"Quite moving, don't you think? Even the Dutch press are treating him like a hero now. Too bad they weren't so glowing in their praise when he was alive. For years they attacked him, all because he had the courage to say the things they chose to ignore. In my judgment, they are complicit in his murder. They are as guilty as the extremist imams who filled Mohammed Hamza's head with hate."
She turned and looked at Gabriel.
"Come," she said. "The house is this way."
They set off down the Stahlstraat together. Gabriel glanced over his shoulder and saw Levon start after them. Sophie Vanderhaus gazed down at the cobbles, as if organizing her thoughts.
"It's been 5 days since his murder," she said, "and not a single Muslim leader has bothered to condemn it. In fact, given a chance to do so by the Dutch media, they have chosen to blame it on him. Where are those so-called moderate Muslims one always hears about in the press? Do they exist? Are they merely figments of our imagination? If one insults the Prophet Muhammad, our Muslim countrymen pour into the streets in a sacred rage and threaten us with beheading. But when one of them commits murder in the Prophet's name..."
Her voice trailed off. Gabriel completed the thought for her. "The silence is deafening."
"Well put," she said. "But you didn't come to Amsterdam to listen to a lecture by me. You have a job to do."
She scrutinized him carefully for a moment while they walked side by side in the narrow street.
"Do you know, Herr Kiva, it was exactly a year ago that Professor Rosner first told me about his relationship with a man named Rudolf Heller, and what I was to do in the event anything ever happened to him? Needless to say, I hope this day would never come."
"I understand you and Professor Rosner were very close."
"He was like a father to me. I had a dozen other job offers when I completed my degree, jobs that paid much more than Center for European Security Studies. But I chose to work for Professor Rosner for a pittance instead."
"You're a historian?"
She nodded.
"While I was researching my thesis, I learned that we Dutch have a habit of trying to reach accommodation with murderous ideologies, be it National Socialism or Islamic Fascism. I wanted to help break that cycle. Working for Professor Rosner gave me that chance."
She pushed a stray lock of hair from her forehead and looked at Gabriel.
"I was at Professor Rosner's side for 5 years, Herr Kiva. I had to endure the taunts and threats as well, and I believe that entitles me to ask a few questions before we start."
"I'm afraid asking too many questions about who I am and why I'm here will make your life more complicated and dangerous than it already is."
"Will you permit me to posit a hypothesis?"
"If you insist."
"I don't believe Herr Rudolf Heller is Swiss, and I certainly don't believe he's a venture capitalist who had an interest in supporting the work of a terrorism analyst in Amsterdam."
"Really?"
"Professor Rosner didn't talk much about his feelings towards Israel. He knew it would only make him more radioactive in Amsterdam than he already was, but he was a Zionist. He believed in Israel and the right of the Jewish people to a homeland, and I suspect that if a clever Israeli intelligence officer came along and made him the right sort of offer, he would have done almost anything to help."
She stopped walking and looked at Gabriel for a moment with one eyebrow raised, as if giving him a chance to respond.
"My name is Heinrich Kiva," he said. "I'm a colleague of Herr Rudolf Heller from Zurich, and I've come to Amsterdam to review the private papers of Professor Solomon Rosner."
She capitulated, though judging from her expression, she remained deeply skeptical of his cover story. Gabriel didn't blame her. It was hardly airtight.
"I hope you're not planning on leaving Amsterdam anytime soon," she said. "At last estimate, we had more than 100,000 pages of documents in our archives."
"I brought help."
"Where?"
Gabriel nodded toward Levon, who was gazing into a shop window 20 yards behind them.
"Since when do Zurich venture capitalists employ professional surveillance men?"
She set off down the Groenbergwall.
"Come on, Herr Kiva. You have a long night ahead of you."
Her original estimate of Rosner's archives proved wildly optimistic. Gabriel, after conducting a brief tour of the canal house, reckoned the true number of pages ran closer to 250,000. There were files in Rosner's office and files in Sophie's. Files lined the hallway, and there was a dank chamber filled with files in the cellar. And then, of course, there was all the material contained on the hard drive of Rosner's computer. So much for Shamroon's prediction that they would be back in Jerusalem by the weekend.
This is the end of disc number 1. Please continue listening on disc number 2.